Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You are listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Jaka. This week, our reporters took a look at immigration. Immigration is easily one of the most divisive subjects right now and a super complicated one. So our reporters tried to simplify some of it for you. This episode is going to be part one of two episodes, and it starts right now on Real College Podcast. Ha-Kung Lee is a refugee living in the United States. Her life and experiences with American culture may look different than one would expect. Marcus Arsvald has a story.
But I remember, like, getting off the car, and it was snowing, and I was like, oh my gosh, there's ice cream, because, you know, like, we have those shave ice cream back in, in the camp, and usually, you know, you have to have money to buy those things. And so when I saw it on the ground, I was like, oh my God, there's so many. I ran, I grabbed one, I grabbed like a handful. I put it in my mouth and ew, that cold, nice feeling. But then I was like, but it doesn't have flavor. My aunt and them were like, what are you doing? I'm like, I thought it was ice cream, right?
You just heard from Pa-Kung Lee, who moved to the United States when she was six. Her mother had fled Laos during the Vietnam War, while Pa's father was assisting American soldiers. Pa was born in a refugee camp in Thailand, where she lived until her aunt sponsored her mother and her family to move to Massachusetts, and then Minneapolis, Minnesota. Pa and I sat on her couch in her St. Paul home to talk about life and what it means to be a refugee.
I say a refugee is someone who is resilient. Yeah, because of, you know, their history, their experience, and despite all of that, they're still able to, like, push through.
Strength is a virtue that Pa radiates with. She was the first of her family to graduate high school, college, and then grad school. She served in the Peace Corps in the Philippines and now works for the federal government. She is incredibly proud of her identity.
They want to not claim that as an identity. And for many reasons, you know, there are some who, people that I know, they don't want to talk about it because now they're an American. So they only want to, like, identify as an American, because depending on the group, sometimes I feel like people don't treat us like we're American. We're not American, you know? And sometimes I feel like that, like, if I'm not American enough, but I'm not a refugee.
It's understandable that people may not want to identify as a refugee, especially considering the way some of them are treated.
You know, growing up, it's always, I look Chinese, so I'm Chinese, so I should just go back to, you know, China. Or that when I speak Hmong, I should not speak Hmong. But they don't know that. They tell me to stop speaking in Chinese, right? And that, hearing that, it's kind of like, oh my gosh, if I'm not American, then what am I?
When I think of a refugee, I'll admit that I immediately go to what I've heard on the radio or see on TV. Images of war-torn countries with civilians jumping fences, swimming through rivers, or getting smuggled into other countries in packed white vans run across my mind.
But for one woman on one boat, the crisis boils down to this.
So, I mean, you know, media, they kind of pick whatever population, whatever issue, topic they want to cover. And there's actually, like, a lot of success in Southeast Asian, you know, community, in the Hmong community. But my view on that is that I feel like they always pick the negative.
Giovanna Del Orto is my history of journalism professor who has experience in international news storytelling and reported for the Associated Press. She held a panel this year with current international correspondents from the AP and the New York Times to give students and the community a place to discuss the way the mainstream media depicts refugees.
One of the problems is that there is episodic coverage that goes with the big, you know, the boat that sinks, the migrants were found in a truck in a Walmart parking lot, you know, dead because they were smuggled and abandoned.
Shortly after midnight, a Walmart employee called 911 after someone approached him in the parking lot and asked for water. Fire Chief Charles Hood said inside a semi-truck parked behind the store, San Antonio paramedics found several dozen overheated people in crisis.
We had 8 patients that were deceased. We had another 20 patients that were either in extremely critical condition or very serious condition, and they've been transported to a number of hospitals.
Or if there is a major political announcement, you know, the refugee travel ban or the refugee ban, or in Europe, you know, an election that's related to a xenophobic or anti-immigrant party, for example. Those tend to be where the attention focuses just because of the nature of the news cycle, that those are things that you cannot not cover.
Fooley, Pa's little brother, was one of 2 refugees that was elected to the Minnesota House of Representatives. Pa wishes that the media would cover the story of successful Hmong refugees, like her brother, Fu, as much as they cover the negative news perpetuating common stereotypes.
When my brother, you know, got elected, there was like a brief mention of him on the news. And that was it, you know. But if it was like another white person, it would be more like, look at all this great things, right?
Pa's adolescent years truly weren't that different from that of an average American kid. She loved the snow, she walked to the school bus, and she was picked on by the older boys in her family.
In Massachusetts, I grew up, you know, with with my sister and Fu, and we were with my aunt and you know, her kids. And so they were boys, so they always mess with me. You know how Freddy Krueger? I have to go to the bus stop, and there's an old house on Elm Street. So they will watch Freddy Krueger, and then they will tell me that Freddy Krueger liked to eat little kid. And so for the longest time, I hated Massachusetts, and I hated Freddy Krueger.
As Pa says, refugees are resilient. This is Real College Radio Podcast, and I'm Marcus Arsvold.
Both St. Paul and Minneapolis are sanctuary cities. That means police are not supposed to aid in the deportation of undocumented immigrants. But there's a lot of confusion about how various law enforcement bodies handle undocumented immigrants in Minnesota. It's complex, confusing, and anything but consistent. Real College Podcast reporter Austin Macklis takes a look at the ways in which law enforcement can circumvent city sanctuary policies.
Last May, a passenger on the Minneapolis Blue Line light rail recorded the interaction between a Metro Transit officer and Ariel Vences Lopez, who was riding the train home from work.
What's your name? That's not what you gave me.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
You have a student ID? You're here illegally? No.
Okay. Are you guys authorized to act as immigration police?
No.
And I would stay out of that. It's very touchy legal territory. That's very touchy legal territory. I would not act on behalf of another agency if you're not legally empowered to do so.
In the video, the officer is heard questioning the immigration status of Vences Lopez, who happened to be an undocumented immigrant. Vences Lopez was arrested and later detained by immigration officials. He was nearly deported. The incident violated Metro Transit's policy. In a statement, Metro Transit Police Chief John Harrington said, "It's not the practice of the Metro Transit Police to inquire about the immigration status of our riders." The officer later resigned. But for many, the wider implications are disconcerting.
It's actually really sad because I remember seeing that was really like, wow. Because it's one thing to see it somewhere else and stuff, but then see it like really close to home is really impactful, especially on public transport that you use, right, every day.
That's Guillermo Perez, a student at the University of Minnesota and a local activist.
Myself not being undocumented and you know, having both a Mexican and U.S. citizenship, you know, I mean, I have the great privilege of not having to worry about that every day. I have plenty of friends, like really like close friends, acquaintances that are either themselves undocumented or have undocumented parents. And, you know, for them, it can be, you know, a day-to-day, week-to-week struggle at times.
The Metro Transit incident only added to the fears of many in the immigrant community. In particular, it raised questions about the authority law enforcement bodies have when it comes to deportation. You, friend. Since 2003, Minneapolis has officially been a sanctuary city. St. Paul is the same. Although that status offers some protection to undocumented immigrants, its legal backing is murky.
Well, there's actually no legal definition, and that's one of the biggest confusions.
That's Linus Chan, a law professor at the university's Detainee Rights Clinic.
The real idea, and if you look at the laws involved, is just telling people in as city officials that they are not part of the immigration enforcement scheme.
In practice, sanctuary status means that city officials don't actively work with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. That's known as the severance policy. It means that the Minneapolis and St. Paul police departments are not allowed to ask about residents' immigration status or citizenship.
If you look at the actual ordinances that talk about the sanctuary cities in both Minneapolis and St. Paul, they're more on the idea that, A, they're not supposed to ask about immigration status, and they're not supposed to care about immigration status.
However, that policy only applies to the city's police officers, not other law enforcement bodies, such as Metro Transit, the State Patrol, or the County Sheriff.
Minnesota, unlike California and unlike Illinois, do not have a statewide policy, right? They've left it up to local level authorities to make a decision about how they are going to cooperate or not cooperate with ICE.
It means that individual law enforcement agencies can decide their own policy for immigration law, leaving the door wide open for coordinating with ICE.
Law enforcement will work with the feds. There's a lot of cooperation when it comes to cities, localities with immigration. For instance, county jails hold immigrant detainees.
Although Metro Transit's policy doesn't allow officers to ask for residents' immigration status, other agencies have not expressed a similar stance.
Despite the fact that the city of Minneapolis is a large part of Hennepin County, Hennepin County itself does not have a whole lot of policies.
That means people like Hennepin County Sheriff Richard Stanek can decide their own policy.
So you have a lot of controversy with Sheriff Stanek on whether or not and how much he is in fact cooperating with ICE. Now, he has made public statements that he would love to cooperate with ICE.
According to Chan, this defeats the very purpose of being a sanctuary city.
It doesn't really matter that the city of Minneapolis is a sanctuary city. It doesn't really matter that St. Paul might be a sanctuary city. They are not the ones that the sheriff needs to be held accountable to.
Perez agrees.
The big issue is that it's essentially rendered moot when you're detained and everything, you're taken to Hennepin County Jail, and there the county, the state, whatever, they're all within their jurisdiction, their rights to ask you those questions, then that's that, and they can contact ICE and get you into the proceedings for deportation.
He would like to see a countywide sanctuary policy. Perez thinks that the piecemeal approach currently used is harmful to immigrant communities.
I think there's a lot of general fear, but at the same time, there's always been fear in the undocumented community, just in general, because, I mean, they can come for you at any time.
Chan also recognizes the fear coming from many undocumented residents.
Someone who is undocumented can drive around in Minneapolis, and they might feel a little bit better that a Minneapolis police officer may not ask them about their immigration status. But if they go outside of the city and into an area outside of the Twin Cities, they might suddenly have to be afraid of what's going to happen in that situation.
For him, it comes back to the poorly constructed application of immigration law.
There's just a lot of confusion, and there's a lot of uncertainty, and there's a lot of fear in the community, right? That's what's going to happen when you have inconsistent enforcement and you have inconsistent ideas.
For Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Austin McAllis.
I'm sorry, but I'm just thinking of the right words to say. I know they don't sound the way I planned them to be. If you wait around a while, I'll make you fall for me. I promise you I will.
It can be incredibly difficult to be in the United States without citizenship papers. It's hard to get jobs, post-secondary education, driver's license, and many other things we would consider essential to living in the U.S. Plus, for many people, there's the ever-present fear of being separated from your family through deportation. People may voluntarily leave the U.S. to accompany a deported family member or may decide to leave because of the obstacles and uncertainty that would lie ahead for them. But for young returnees, this can mean heading to an unknown country. While we hear about the increase in deportations in the U.S., we don't hear about what happens after quite as much. Maggie Loretto was one of these returnees. Now co-director of Otras Dreams en Acción, an activism organization based out of Mexico City that seeks to help the increasing numbers of deportees and returnees either integrate into life in an unknown country or get back to the U.S. She has experiences with the obstacles undocumented immigrants face in the U.S. and on the return to Mexico. Liv Riggin spoke with her about why she left the U.S. and what it's like to be back in an unknown Mexico.
Many people, or the majority of the people in the U.S., never ask themselves what happens post-deportation or what happens when a family disappears from my neighborhood. Where did they go? I mean, they are probably in Mexico or in their country of origin, but what's with their life?
Maggie had lived almost her whole life in Georgia when she realized she might need to leave.
In my case, I was trying to enter college, so I was trying to look up for grants and scholarships, or I was wanting to get a driver's license or get a part-time job like all my friends, and suddenly I realized that I'm not going to be able to get all that stuff and that things might get worse after 18. That meant that if I wanted to work, I would have to find other ways, that I wasn't going to be able to go into college. You realize that you don't have rights anymore.
Either choice of going to Mexico or staying in the U.S. carries a lot of uncertainty.
When they decide, they go through a period of what's going to be happening with my future. Will I be able to study or will I be able to work in what I like? So those are many of the obstacles. And now and then, as we all know, because of Trump and everything, I mean, the racism, the hate, everything is on the air even more.
When you can't get the education you want, may not be able to get a job, are under the fear of arrest and deportation and facing racism, it can make sense to leave.
We're back to an unknown Mexico.
And there are challenges that come along with that.
For example, revalidating our U.S. studies took me 5 years. Many of the people have been struggling with that because it was being impossible, not only for people in like college level, but also little kids that were going back with their deported parents, and they didn't know that they needed all of these documents that they could only get in the U.S., and obviously they couldn't go back. Getting identity documents or people just pointing out at you because of your accent or because you look like you belong there, but you don't. Once they talk to you, it's like, who are you? Like, not understanding even the jokes or how to move around. Everything was really new. And I mean, we have to be realistic. I mean, going back to a country that you don't know and not because you want it is very hard. I think it's important to also be realistic that Mexico is a beautiful country. I love it. I mean, I studied tourism and I love the country, but also be realistic that it's a country where there is a lot of impunity and a lot of corruption. And right now, the Mexican government has really not stood up to the situation. in terms of creating a program that will reintegrate these families and these young people. So there were a lot of work around pushing and demanding the government.
It's begun to pay off, although Maggie notes that we should wait to see if the laws are actually implemented and how they're implemented before beginning to celebrate. Peña Nieto, the Mexican president, issued a declaration urging Congress to simplify the revalidation process. Within 3 months, a bill had been passed. Additionally, the GED is now being accepted in Mexico, a huge step up as deportees and returnees with the GED were previously counted as not having a high school education, which really limits job choices and possible education in the future. Still, it can be hard for returnees to get jobs with limited Spanish, a small social network, and little understanding of how things work in Mexico. Low-wage call centers, many of which are created as a result of NAFTA's free trade zones, benefit from increasing deportation. They get workers with a U.S. education, fluent English, and few other options, so they can pay them in pesos rather than dollars at rates around $100 for 40 hours of work. But for returnees, it's one of the only options available. Maggie and others in Otras Streams in Acción have been trying to change that.
It has been the only door that has been opened for our community of deportees and returnees, right? Because they know English without an accent, because they know the culture. So, I mean, every time you call and complain or report a problem with your dish service or your phone or your AT&T or whatever, just have in mind that that person that's assisting you is probably a person that was deported and that grew up his whole life here and is on the other side of the border. So what we're really doing is creating opportunities besides the call centers. I mean, the call centers are like a good option to get back on your feet, but you shouldn't be stuck in there. You know, it could be another dead end and a limbo. So creating alternatives, I think, is one of the biggest part of all the, besides access to education, working with the universities in Mexico, and as I said, that mobility and eventually having a family reunification.
With deportation increasing and the DACA program expiring, it's getting increasingly difficult to have those family reunifications. For people in the U.S., Maggie says preparation and solidarity are the keys to getting ready for the chance of deportation.
It's important for people to also prepare and to have a plan in case that happens. But as well, I mean, mentally prepare or as much as you can because you think you're prepared. But once you arrive, you realize that you're not. But at least knowing what organizations, where you can like get their kids the double nationality or get all those papers. And to try to be in touch with the community in terms of the dreamers here. I mean, or for example, if the mom stays here and they deport the son, you can be in contact with us and tell us, you know what, he's in Mexico City. We meet with him. I mean, just talking to him and him knowing that he's not alone or she's not alone makes a difference. And then we start growing and working from there. Try to see how we can fight together, how we can work together. Because at the end of the day, there are people on the other side of the border that could have been your friends or even your family now and then. The U.S. will always be part of us. It's our hometown. It's where we were formed and it's where we grew up. So we can't just say, okay, I'm going to Mexico and I'm forgetting about it because our families are here, because this is our place.
This is also what Dipinder Mayal, director of the James H. Binger Center for New Americans at the U of M's Law School, sees when he leads students in the Education and Outreach Program, doing pro bono screenings for undocumented immigrants in rural Minnesota to see if they may have a potential claim for protection or legal status.
There are so many people who are American in all other ways except for this determination. It's like, what is the idea of being from a place? What is the idea of citizenship? You know, we have people who have grown up here, speak only English, have contributed to society, have paid taxes, have done everything it is to belong to a place that anyone else has done. And at what point does that person confer the right to call that place their home? It's a question that I think that is not just an American-Mexican question. This is a question that the world will be facing. Migration is up around the world. What are the rights of people who are moving around the planet? One of the most fundamental aspects about being a human is movement. Tens of thousands of years, humans have moved. And it's part of what allows, you know, us to change and grow and our cultures to form and to merge. So I think these are fundamental questions. Do we try to create a community where we reflect what is natural human tendencies, as well as the movement of economic capital? Or do we try to block it all off?
We all aspire to have that mobility. The U.S. will always be part of us. I mean, our families are separated by the border. Obviously, if you're separated from your family, I don't think it'll ever be okay. But knowing that we're all going to fight together.
I'm Liv Riggins for Radio K's Real College Podcast. That is all for this week's episode of Real College Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. You can hear all of our episodes at radiok.org/Real College Podcast. You can also subscribe on iTunes. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Alex Schumacher, Emily Allen, and Liv Riggins. I'm your host and managing editor, Jake Maldonado Medina. Thank you so much for listening, and tune in every Monday at 6:30 for more arts and culture coverage.